Across the city and South Cambridgeshire.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
I'm going to read you the menu. It's fantastic.
The time is right for this sort of thing.
Food is everything.
Cambridge is right for this sort of thing.
What's it like? Condicious.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour. Our thanks to Ollie Slack for From the Pavilion. And now it is time for an hour of good old food and drink with Alan Alder and myself, Matt Bentman. And Sue Bailey is away this week.
Amongst today's features, we speak with Tristan Welch of Parker's Tavern in the University Arms Hotel about his reaction to the demise of much of Jamie Oliver's empire.
I knew Jamie personally for many years. I haven't spoken to him for, about 8 years probably. He's that genuine guy. Is that genuine guy?
And Tristan Welch and Rosie Sykes give us some recipe ideas for asparagus, very much in the shops and on the market stalls at the moment, so you might want to jot down some ideas.
My favourite thing to eat with asparagus is a Spanish sauce based on the Spanish soup ajo blanco.
We find out about Love Your Local Market, the two-week celebration that's on now, and also about the process for deciding how the market can be upgraded.
We are currently undergoing a market redevelopment project. We're currently only in REBA Stage 1, which is the feasibility of what could happen to the market.
I visit a specialist wine importer.
Although we only knew him since, say, a year ago when we started this journey, but he just immediately welcomed us into the family. Every time we go there, it's impossible not to eat something or drink something with them. It's just that we tried, believe me, but it's not possible.
And I visit Meadows, the new shop in Newnham, whose produce comes entirely from the sorts of small producers we feature here on Flavour.
Yeah, so this is Cimi di Rapa, Italian greens. They're turnip tops, really, and they're used a lot in Italian cooking. They're very popular. You just would sauté them down with a bit of chilli and garlic and have them either as a side dish or stirred into pasta.
And in amongst all this, we will be getting updates from Twitter about food and drink in and around Cambridge, what free food is available locally, and we'll also have a roundup of local food news at the end of the programme, including details of a new Spanish restaurant coming to the centre of Cambridge.
Tequila! Now, one of the main food stories in the press this week was the closure of almost all of Jamie Oliver's restaurants, including those in Wheeler Street here in Cambridge. It follows the closure of branches of a lot of other chain restaurants, so clearly there is a problem. The accountancy firm UHY Hacker Young, who we don't mention often enough, I think, has found that almost half the UK's top restaurant groups are making a loss. There appear to be a number of reasons. Home deliveries by firms like Deliveroo and Just Eat, the increase in the minimum wage, the big increase in business rates and rents in many areas, and also people's general lack of money and the tired nature of what a lot of chains offer. I spoke with Tristan Welch of Parker's Tavern about Jamie Oliver.
I think it's tremendously bad news. I feel terrible for Jamie because he set out with the best intentions ever, with his low sugar, high quality ingredients. He really set out to do the best he could for the industry in the mid-range market. I think it's wonderful what he did with kids' meals. I think he had the best kids' meals of any restaurant, really. I think he looked after his team extremely well. I think he had great sites. Maybe us as a nation have probably let him down a little bit. It's really tough. Was the food consistent enough? Probably not. Was it versatile? Did it change enough with customers' perceptions? Yes. Did he try and change customers' perceptions a little bit too much in some areas? Possibly. I just feel terrible for the chap because he started off with the best intentions. He was true to his word. He put his money where his mouth was. But, you know, failures happen to the best of us, and I'm sure he will rise from the ashes stronger and better. If not, I wish him a very good retirement because, good Lord, he deserves it.
Yes.
He really does.
But, I mean, it is part of a pattern, isn't it? I mean, Carluccio, Strada, Cow,
yep.
Various places. I mean, is there a deeper problem?
Yeah, there's a massive problem, and I believe chain restaurants and the mid-market are really killing the industry. They're de-skilling the industry.
In what way?
Well, a large percentage of their food is prepared off-site. We're quite novel here. We make our mashed potato fresh. But now it's cheaper and easier to buy frozen nuggets of mashed potato. And that's de-skilling the industry. It's horrendous. It's not nutritious. And it's nowhere near as good. But people are settling for it, or they were settling for it. And now, obviously, they're voting with their feet and their mouths and everything. They're not going to these restaurants as much. I believe chains have tried to trivialise the fun of eating out. They've made it too regular, too easy. You know, it'd be very easy for me to say, let's save ourselves £5,000 a month and not use tablecloths whatsoever. But it's a lovely thing to sit at a table with a white tablecloth. It's an event. Okay, nobody eats out every night of the week. If they do, shame on them. But when they do, they should have a white tablecloth. They should sit down and be served correctly and all that sort of stuff. You know, what we do here at Parker's Tavern, we buy the best quality produce we can possibly buy and serve it at the best price we can possibly buy. And you know what? Some days we just don't make money on it. It's really tough. However, by doing so, it reaffirms our quality and our uniqueness, which is what the other restaurants didn't have. Can we afford not to make money some days? Not really, but can we afford not to? I don't know. You know, restaurants are a low-margin business. They always have been. I think for the safety of the industry, for the safety of the future, we have to be really careful about how we prepare food and how we serve it and how we train and look after the team that are going to be serving us later on in life. You know, I think it's by trying to make too much money out of something which is a low margin business, they're probably killing themselves a bit. And there's restaurants out there, these chains, which will pay £250,000 per year in the rent. What sort of restaurant do you want to sit in that's paying £250,000 in rent? How much money is actually going into that food? And what are you putting into your bodies when you eat that? What sort of quality is that? Yeah, it raises so many questions, it's unbelievable. So I can see why some of them are sinking. Jamie's, I'm incredibly sad about them.
I mean, he did a lot of things which were sort of very socially aware. I mean, you've mentioned his work, say, on sugar. There was also the way he set up 15...
Yeah,
and you know, employed people who wouldn't otherwise have that sort of opportunity. I suppose the cynic would wonder whether this is just brilliant marketing, that this separates Jamie from the rest of the crowd and makes him stand out, or is it actually what he's like? Have you an insight into that?
I guess you could say it's brilliant marketing. I knew Jamie personally for many years. I haven't spoken to him for about 8 years probably. He's that genuine guy. He's that genuine guy. I mean, he started 15 before anything else, right? And he started it with the very best intentions. Okay, he did get a BBC Two series out of it. I just can't help but think it was a positive thing that the industry only benefited from. And I do believe the industry is benefiting from his legacy of James Italian.
Yes, well, I think it's rather sad as well. Tristan Welch from Parker's Tavern there. Actually, while I was talking with Tristan, I wondered if he'd read the story of the customer at the branch of Hawksmoor in Manchester who was given a £4,500 bottle of wine in error. He'd ordered one that cost a mere £260. Sometime later, another member of staff said, "Ooh, someone's drinking a very impressive wine, and at the bar," and that's when they realised. But the customer then ordered a second bottle, and the manager tactfully suggested they order a different one without letting them know what had happened. I asked Tristan what was the most expensive bottle he'd ever sold.
I was head chef of a restaurant called Petrus for many years, and I think it was round about the £80,000. No, that was the whole bill. That was the whole bill. But there was a £46,000 bottle on there and a couple of £26,000 as well, something like that. It was incredible. So we used to have the most amazing wine list.
So what's a £46,000 bottle of wine? What was it?
I think it was probably... Oh, no, you're putting me on the spot. Maybe a Mouton Rothschild, 82, something like that. Something that was really special. I'll let you into a little secret I've probably never told anybody. Hey, when you're the head chef of places like this, wine drinkers are very generous in general. They will give you a little glass just for the chef to taste and all that sort of stuff. I was a young chap at the time, but I found it very... I struggled to get past the tannins in a lot of these big wines because they are so rich and so strong that actually I never really understood them, and I long to taste these wines again. Mm. So I can actually... Now I know a little bit more about wine. I've certainly drunk a lot more wine since then. I would love to taste them again to really gauge, is it exclusivity or is it actual quality, mind-blowing, euphoric flavours? And I think a lot of the stuff is... There's a fine balance. When we created the wine list here, actually, I found there's a fine balance of exclusivity versus deliciousness. And surely what's the most important thing is absolute deliciousness. Exclusivity is all very... I don't think I can say it in a polite way on the radio, to be honest.
And that was Tristan Welch there.
Yeah, I'd love to try a £46,000 bottle of wine as well, but I don't suppose I ever will.
Now, in Eltersley Avenue in Newnham, at number 31 is Meadows, the pop-up shop opened as part of the Eat Cambridge Festival by Susanna Watson. However, it's going to outlive this year's festival, and it's likely to be a permanent fixture, as we will hear. So first, Alan had a look around with Susanna at some of the items on sale.
Right, Susanna, I've been in several times now, and every time I come in, I find more things, and for quite a small shop, that's an achievement. But when we come in, the first thing that we see is of these fantastic greens, which really look superb. Where are these from?
These come from Flourish Produce, just south of Cambridge, on the road between Hildesham and Linton. And Calixta has been farming there for 3 years, and she's got two working horses, Bill and Ben, and they do the heavy lifting. And otherwise, it's all farmed by hand.
Yeah, and some quite unusual items as well. What's this one?
Yeah, so this is Cimi di Rapa, Italian greens. They're turnip tops, really, and they're used a lot in Italian cooking. They're very popular. You just would saute them down with a bit of chili and garlic and have them either as a side dish or stirred into pasta. The flavour's a little bit like purple sprouting broccoli.
Right, and I'd noticed, I don't think you've got any today, but yesterday you had some asparagus, which actually is the greenest looking asparagus I've ever seen.
Well, that would have been freshly cut on the morning it's delivered, and so that's a real edge that we have with those veggies as well. Not only are they interesting varieties and interesting greens, they are very, very freshly harvested, and what you would buy in the supermarket was probably picked weeks ago.
And also, there's some, well, quite a lot of bread as well. Is that delivered fresh daily?
Yeah, so we have a different delivery every day. We have bread from Alison McTaggart of Bread on a Bike, Katie Moore from Allotment Cafe, and Luca, who has set up his bakery in Ely, Grain Culture. So they each deliver a sourdough or a selection of sourdoughs every day, and then each of them have their different specialities as well. So,
right, I mean, there were bagels here on Sunday, for example.
Yes, Alison's our bagel specialist, and then Luca does amazing pretzels and little sourdough brioche buns, and Katie does a larger chocolate brioche, which is to die for.
I was looking at these olives.
Well, the olives are from Olivology, which is a small business based in Borough Market in London. And I've known Mariana for a long time. She started her business by importing olives. The olives are cured in water and ferment slowly, whereas a lot of commercial olives are mechanically cured or cured using chemical treatments and also dyed to appear riper than they are. So these are handled much more naturally in the way that they should be, and they taste absolutely delicious as well. They've got a really intense flavour. So if you're using them as an ingredient, you would use one, where in another dish you may need two, or with another olive you may need two.
Yeah, yeah. And I noticed also that Olivology is supplying various nuts as well.
Yeah, so she has an amazing selection of almonds, pistachios and walnuts, again from Greece. Greece is a great resource in Europe, which we probably underestimate a little bit because Spain and Italy tends to reach us first. But a lot of the farming there has never altered from traditional methods of farming, and so remains very much organic. And so for organic ingredients of really good quality, it's a real go-to place.
Right, so is that where the olive oil presumably comes from,
so
there as well?
Yeah, she has a couple of different pressings. So the 18 degrees is the first pressing, pressed at cool temperatures. Right. You get a really, really intense flavour from the oil. And then the 22 degrees is a little later in the harvest, higher temperatures, so it's a little bit lighter.
Mm. Moving over here, there's a producer here, Cucina di William, who I've not come across before.
So William's based down the road in Peterborough, and he works directly with a family in Abruzzo in Italy, and they grow everything that's in the range. So they produce pastas, oils and pasta sauces, but it's all come from one farm. So they grow the wheat, which is milled for them locally, they grow the olives, and they grow all the vegetables that go into their sauces and into the flavoured oils as well. So it's really nice that it's direct from one family.
Yes, it is, isn't it? Yeah. There's pasta here of, well, sometimes, like, particularly this one, that you don't see that often, I think.
Yeah, this is the orecchietti, which is the little ears. And it has a sort of cult following, orecchietti, and you told me that you've seen it in the press lately. It's a really good pasta to use if you actually don't want to have a sauce. So for something like the cimi di rapa we talked about before, if you were sautéing that down but you wanted to just stir some pasta through it, this would be the ideal type of pasta for that.
Right, I'm moving over to the chiller. Lots of cheeses, which is what we'd expect, and the two I've had have been extraordinarily good. But you've also got some French butter.
Yes, so the butter is from Étrez. It's in the east of France, close to Switzerland, and they do two types. They're plain, unsalted, but cultured butter, and the salted has salt, Swiss rock salt in it, but it's in the crystals. So you can really taste the salt, which is really nice.
Oh, how lovely. Yeah, and French yogurts as well.
Yeah, the yogurts are delicious. They're made with organic milk, and the fruit jams inside are homemade as well.
Right, over here, lots of drinks. Calverley's Brewery, which we've mentioned many times on the programme before, and Cambridge Distillery's gin, but also some Gimlet Bar.
Yeah, so the Gimlet Bar drinks are their cordials. They are a non-alcoholic cordial that are used as mixers in cocktails or are really delicious diluted with sparkling water as well.
And Susanna, you have a range of natural wines, but also you've got some tea. Can you tell me a bit about the tea?
So the tea is a brand from London, Good and Proper Tea, and Emily, who's the founder of that business that was set up about 5 years ago, moved from advertising because she became interested in tea, primarily because whenever she had client meetings and went out for proper coffees in the local cafes, she was often served the same tea that she would either have at home or in her office, and she felt that there was probably more tea out there. So she's becoming a tea expert.
And chocolates, I mean, you've got some Bumble and Oat chocolate, which we have talked about before on Flavour, and they are extremely local.
Exactly, made in Newnham, can't get much closer
you
than
can't,
that.
No, but Pump Street chocolate.
So Pump Street chocolate we consider to be local. It's an East Anglian brand from Orford in Suffolk. That was established as a sort of offshoot from Pump Street Bakery. The bread ovens were used to roast cocoa beans, and then the chocolate bars were made from that. So it started in the bakery and has now grown to the point where they're two separate entities, but it's a nice story that they've evolved from bread making. And they do have a couple of interesting bars that include the bread in the chocolate. So they've got the rye crumb and sea salt and the sourdough and sea salt, and there the bread is featured in the chocolate bar, giving it texture, where in other bars you might have some nuts or honeycomb or something like that.
Very unusual. And also Jamaican chocolate as well. That's not something you see very often.
Yeah, so that's Amesha's favourite bar, and it's nice to have cocoa beans from all different origins. Yeah.
Right, now, I know you're here as a sort of pop-up for Eat Cambridge, but I hear you're extending beyond Eat Cambridge.
Yes, so we are coming back again for our summer stint here in Newnham, and we'll be open every Friday to Sunday for June, July and the best part of August. So if anybody's passing through Newnham and needs a gelato and some nice shopping, we'll look forward to seeing lots of people here through the summer as well.
Right, and then at the end of summer?
We hope to stay permanently, so we will probably have a brief closure to refit the shop. If we're going to move in permanently, we'll need to not be so much of a pop-up and more fixtures and fittings and shelves, etc. So we'll hopefully stay the distance.
And that was Susanna Watson at Meadows, number 31 Eltersley Avenue, next to the pharmacy, across the road from the butcher and the Saturday fish van, round the corner from the bakery and near to the Derby stores. The area is becoming a foodie paradise. Actually, one of the products at Meadows that we didn't emphasise enough, perhaps, was Jack's Gelato. Marvellous.
Now, at the beginning of that interview, Susanna said about the asparagus being picked that morning, and that ties in very nicely with our next feature, which is about asparagus. And here is Flavour's Liz Budd with some information about it.
Asparagus, according to Jane Grigson in her vegetable book, needs to be eaten the day it's cut. She says it should be served warm or cold, rather than hot, from the pan, as it's eaten with the fingers. One sometimes sees white asparagus for sale, which is produced by earthing up the asparagus shoots so no light gets to them. Nikki Segnett's not impressed by this form. She describes it in the Flavour Thesaurus as a slimy, anemic tube, free of the rich nuttiness that makes proper green asparagus such a treat. She continues, "For some reason, the Spanish, who have so much to commend them gastronomically, put it in salads where it lies hidden in the leaves like a chef's long-forgotten finger."
Well, now our resident chef, Rosie Sykes, with some ideas for what to do with asparagus.
Asparagus is one of my favourites, and I try and eat it as many days of the week that I can while it's in season, because I don't believe in eating asparagus from anywhere else in the world. In fact, I have a friend over from America who is British, and they said that whenever they're back in asparagus season, they have to have it as much as possible. So my favourite thing to eat with asparagus is a Spanish sauce based on the Spanish soup ajo blanco, which is an almond dressing, basically. So ajo blanco is often an almond soup, chilled almond soup served with grapes. Really delicious, but quite hard to have a whole bowl of. But if you make it a bit thicker as a kind of coating sauce with asparagus, it is off the hook. So basically toast some almonds, throw them in the food processor with a bit of hot water just to bring them to a paste. Add some sherry vinegar, a clove of garlic and some olive oil, salt and pepper. Really simple. I love throwing asparagus in the oven. Just when it's fresh and young, it takes very little time. Bit of salt and pepper, tiny bit of olive oil into a hot oven and just kind of roast it, and it really comes out beautifully. But again, with anchovy butter and a soft-boiled egg, you know, in a tart, there are so many possibilities with asparagus, I think.
And here's Tristan Welch from Parker's Tavern in the University Arms Hotel, also on the subject of asparagus. Tristan, we're at the height of the asparagus season. Have you got any good ideas for asparagus?
I'm so excited about asparagus season. I love it. Do you know what I really adore about asparagus is the simplicity it requires to cook it. So just in a pan with a knob of butter or a tablespoon of oil, just barely cover them with water, so maybe about a centimetre deep of water, no more, on a very high heat, pinch of salt, and you let the water reduce down to absolutely nothing. The butter will coat the asparagus, or the oil will coat the asparagus, and you'll have perfectly seasoned, perfectly cooked asparagus in a one-pan wonder.
Nice and simple.
Nice and simple, yeah.
Nice and simple indeed. Now, when I was looking into asparagus, I did come across a couple of health warnings. Well, perhaps not health warnings, but comments about what they do to you. One of them says that asparagus is an aphrodisiac. Mm-hmm. And the other one said asparagus is a diuretic. So you do have to be very careful if you've eaten a lot of asparagus. It could all end very badly.
And have you any favourite recipes yourself for asparagus?
Yeah, the one I think that I make the most is from a Nigel Slater book. I think it's Kitchen Diaries 2, and it's asparagus on sort of a puff pastry. You cut some rectangles of puff pastry, cook the asparagus until boil the asparagus until it's just about tender, put them on the rectangle of puff pastry on a sort of a sauce that you've made from melting parmesan into double cream or creme fraiche, and then put some more sauce on top, pop it in the oven. When it's brown, take it out and eat it, and it's lovely.
Sounds very nice and rich, that.
I'm free. I'm free.
Right, and now details of free food from the Olio app.
Yes, Olio, for anybody who doesn't know, is free to download on iOS and Android phones and tablets. And using your location, it'll tell you the free food that is nearest to you. And a quick look at Olio today tells us that Anna has some vegetable crisps going spare. Please bring your own containers, she says. Collection is anytime. She's based off Adams Road, which is near Cambridge University Library. And Claire has a variety of prêt-à-manger sandwiches going free to a good home. That includes free-range egg mayonnaise, tuna melts, and an egg spinach protein pot. All are available for pickup as soon as possible, she says, and Claire is based on Gilbert Road. And finally, Nicola, who is around Orchard Park, has a litre of semi-skim long-life milk, which she can leave outside for you. And that's just some of the things available today on the Olio app.
And a reminder that some food outlets sell any unsold goods they have shortly before they close using the Too Good To Go app.
Last night, there was another successful night market in Market Square. Along with a couple of films being shown, there were plenty of stalls open. This is all part of the annual Love Your Local Market celebrations, and there is more to come. Alan spoke with Tim Jones, market manager from Cambridge City Council.
Tim, Love Your Local Market is well underway. There's the open night market last night and the cinema. What else is happening as far as food is concerned?
OK, well, Love Your Local Market takes place from the 17th to the 31st of May. It's a national campaign for highlighting markets nationally. We're very lucky in Cambridge that we've got a thriving seven-day-a-week market. In terms of the events happening, we've got the, as you alluded to, the night market. We have International Food Day taking place next Tuesday. So that will be, what, Tuesday the 28th, I believe. I haven't checked my dates, but I think that's the correct date.
So what does that involve?
So that will be highlighting all the food that we've got on offer here. It's rather sort of a melting pot of cuisine in Cambridge Market Square. We've got a diverse range of food, so we're ranging from Nigerian, Malaysian, Venezuelan, Mediterranean, Indian, British food, you name it, we've got it on the Market Square. So we'll be highlighting that on Tuesday. We'll have food demonstrations going on throughout the day, so we would encourage people to come down and support our local businesses.
That sounds good to me. What do the demonstrations involve?
I believe that will be using ingredients from the market and showing the members of the public how to make a quick dish utilising our fresh ingredients from our market traders.
Right. And aside from food for a moment, there's something going on with bicycles.
Okay, so we've got two bicycle guys on the market, not only selling but repairing. So they're offering free MOT services to come and check your chains, your tyres, your pressures. So come along and they'll take a look at your bike and tell you what needs to be done to it.
Right, very good. What's the future of the market? I mean, there's always rumours that it's under threat and so on. Is the City Council committee committed to it?
Okay, absolutely. So we are currently undergoing a market redevelopment project. We're currently only in REBA stage one, which is the feasibility of what could happen to the market. First and foremost, I'd like to sort of reassure people that the market's here to stay. It should be the jewel in the crown for Cambridge, and it needs livening up. So we're looking at various different things that we could do to the market. They will be engaging with the wider community in the next stage to see what their input is to move forward.
Right. So people don't need to feel threatened?
Absolutely not. No. You know, like I say, it's here to stay. This is the market square. It's been here for hundreds of years, and it will be here for hundreds of years more to come. But it's, you know, it needs updating. There are certain things that we need to look at, and this is exactly the opportunity for the feasibility stage.
Right. Have you got any sort of time scale on how long it might take before
decisions
have been made?
Yeah. How long's a piece of string? You know, we are undergoing the feasibility stage at this point in time. That will then move on to the next stage, which will be key stakeholder engagement. So obviously the traders are key to that process, but there are a number of other stakeholders that we need to engage with as well. That will help formulate a concept design, at which point we'll then go to committee, I believe in October later in the year. At that point, if that gets the go-ahead, we'll then consult with the wider community.
Yeah. Right, OK, well, we'll look forward to hearing about it. Thanks very much,
Tim. No problem at all.
Yes, and we'll be keeping you up to date with the proposals for the market when we get them later in the year. And thanks to Tim Jones there. And there's the familiar music for the latest food tweets from the city.
Yes, Calverley's Brewery has tweeted. They're very regular with their tweets. They're open now with Pizza Mondo until 3 o'clock, and then Pizza Mondo will be there again in Hooper Street from 6 o'clock until 9 p.m. Bushel Box Farm have tweeted lots today. One of them to say they grow their own asparagus. So actually, why not head out to Station Road in Willingham and buy some of the fresh stuff, not the weeks-old spears you get in supermarkets. And they've also just got some honeycomb in from a local honey supplier. Provenance Bricks and Mortar in Whittlesford have tweeted a very appealing picture of a steak dish. And we've had some very good reports about Bricks and Mortar from some really quite hard-to-please people, so worth popping along there. And finally for today, Brewboard in Harston. The tap room is open until 6 o'clock this evening. Now, a couple of weeks ago, there was an article in The Guardian about restaurant noise. It's a long-running issue. We did a piece on flavour about it in September 2014, which you can listen to still, but here's an extract. When you go to a restaurant, you sometimes find you're in a room so noisy that you can barely hear your friends speak. Or you might be somewhere so quiet that you can clearly hear the conversation. Plenty don't. It's a big issue. Here are the thoughts of some people in Cambridge.
Well, we don't like it, so we would probably walk out if it was quite noisy. So if the music was too noisy, or if it was like a clunky sort of hearing all the cups and plates banging around, cluttering, we probably wouldn't stay.
Yeah. A restaurant should be fairly quiet, in my opinion, because you want to rest and you want to chill, you want to enjoy the food and not shout to each other. Yeah, it's all nice.
So it depends on what kind of restaurant it is to what kind of atmosphere that it should or shouldn't have.
I recently visited a convention in Coventry, mm-hmm. and we stayed at a Premier Inn, and they had a restaurant next door. So the family and I went in one evening, and it was too much.
Yeah.
You know, the boom, 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 boom noise. So we just said, have you got a quiet spot? So they took us to a quieter spot, which was still too noisy. So we ended up going to the local pub across the road. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, it's nice to have background music, but not to be sort of, like, overwhelming. And it seems, I don't know really if it's what people really want, or whether they're just trying to draw a younger type of generation, I don't know.
As one of those people said, noise can be used to attract the young. Here's Tim Hayward of Fitzbillies and food writer at the Financial Times talking about the Hard Rock Cafe.
One of my very first restaurant jobs was in the Hard Rock Cafe in San Francisco. And I met the guy who was the founder. He came to visit us one day, and we were chatting about the principle behind the place. He said, you have to understand... He was an English guy. And he said, you have to understand that American young American people are often very nervous about restaurants. they feel that they're full of snotty French-speaking waiters who are there to humiliate them. And many of the people that come in here will come from small towns, and this will be the only restaurant they go to during the year. And he said, so what we worked out was that we needed to give them something to talk about. And so we put stuff on the walls that they would recognise. So everybody recognises music memorabilia, so it gives them something to talk about. We gave them waitresses their own age and food that everybody could recognise, kind of hamburgers and things like that. He said, of course, the other thing is if they can't make conversation, you could always crank the music off and they feel much better. So it actually, for a certain kind of audience group, it really works brilliantly because it they don't need to make conversation. They don't want to make conversation. Yeah. They just want to be there and sort of look at each other, smile a bit, and, oh, I recognise this. And that's kind of nice. The recognition factor makes it comfortable.
Places like Smokeworks in Free School Lane, whose target is younger eaters, are deliberately noisy. It creates an exciting, adrenaline-filled atmosphere, perfect for the food and the clientele. But that's not what everyone wants, at least not all the time. Here's Sarah Lavelle, Cambridge resident, talking about whether noise is much of an issue.
I think it is. It would certainly influence my choice as to where I go. I have a friend who is quite hard of hearing, and we went to a new London pub relatively recently, and we were trying to discuss work, and it was so bad that we actually had to leave because we were just shouting at each other. And when you're watching each other lip read, it's not the best way to get things done. And also, if going anywhere with family when you've got older relatives is extraordinarily difficult, it influences my choice in terms of my dad, who's quite hard of hearing. I do think it's something they should think about.
But why is it difficult to hear people above other noise? And why is it increasingly difficult as we get older? Hearing expert Rosie Frost explains.
Some degree of hearing loss is quite common in older people because your hearing system is very vulnerable to ageing. And a lot of people might have some degree of very mild hearing loss, which they may not even be aware of. But that particularly affects your speech perception, so recognising words. The second part of the changes that happen with age are within the brain, your attention and your memory, in order to process sound, and the ability to pick out sound against background noise is one of the things that becomes harder as you get older. Everybody uses lip reading to a certain extent, and you will do even more when you're in a noisy restaurant environment. And I guess if you're older, then perhaps if your eyesight's a little bit weaker, you struggle a bit more with the lip reading as well. So that can be another contributing factor.
So concentrating on what the person you are speaking to is saying, yes, is harder against the noise of what everybody else in the restaurant is saying.
That's right. Your brain finds it harder to pull out that one speech signal against the general background noise. Unfortunately, there's nothing you can do to avoid the process of ageing, but it's probably quite sensible to pick restaurants where they have good acoustic environment and you're not struggling to compete in an environment where sound is bouncing off against walls and tables and thus confusing your auditory environment even more.
And do you know if there's any websites that rates restaurants' acoustic environments?
I haven't heard of any particularly. It's an interesting question. But I also think that the difficulty hearing in restaurants is not just one that affects older people. I think younger people do, but perhaps they're just more tolerant of it because it's the place to be seen.
So what can restaurateurs do about poor acoustic environments made worse by the fashion for hard surfaces? Richard Bradley is co-owner of Smokeworks, as well as the Cock at Hemmingford Grey, the Tickle Arms and the Two Chop Houses in Cambridge. I asked him what can be done above noise from the street, not from within the Cambridge Chop House where we met.
Richard, the fashion in restaurants, and it's a very appealing fashion, is for sort of clean surfaces, hard surfaces, and they look great, but it can be very noisy. Is there anything that can be done about it?
Yes, at the Cock in Hemmingford Grey and the Tickle Arms, we actually have cassettes that we have suspended off the ceiling, and on the walls at both restaurants we also have what look like pretty bad pieces of art. They do soften the noise.
Because just of what they're made of?
Yes, it's sort of a material we have on the walls. It's like a beige The ones from the ceiling, I think they're more like a foam underneath a bit of material.
Right, so they just absorb some of the sound.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, great.
Okay. But they seem to work. Well, they do work.
Yeah.
The complaints, we don't have complaints anymore about the sound.
This question of hard surfaces, what do you do if that's how you want your restaurant to look? Minimalist, with no pictures on the wall. Tim Hayward again.
Yeah, there's some good technology for sand in restaurants. I was really surprised to chat to a chap who was an expert on it, who'd just gone to a London restaurant where they really didn't want to change their beautiful marble on the walls and their hard surfaces and their glass, but it was impossible to talk. And he installed carpet on the underside of all the tables. And if you think about it, of course, you can put the same surface area of sound-absorbing material just in a place you can't see it. Mm. So it didn't damage the marble floors, didn't damage the marble walls, just put a thick layer of shag pile under each table. And it helps them.
But, as Tim Hayward explained, some restaurants are too quiet.
There's one particular dining room that I went to check out, which is a private dining room on the very, very top of the Gherkin in London. And I thought it was one of the most exciting places I'd actually sort of sat and to chat about. And I was talking to the manageress of the place, and she said, well, we have a real problem with this place, because, of course, everybody here is a city boy, and they're all discussing top-secret stuff. And she said, if you go and stand over there. I went over and stood by the glass on the opposite side where she pointed. And she went and sat on a table on the opposite side of the room and very, very quietly whispered, you can hear me, can't you? Mm. And of course I could. Every single word was coming over the top of this thing. And right, I mean, you literally could have eavesdropped a serious banker's conversation. And they were putting in soundproofing at that point, which made that work better. I think my worst sound experience was going to an extremely pretentious and starred restaurant in another town way away. And we sat and ate. What they'd done is that they had as many posh places do, they'd had their own crockery made. And this had been beautifully done by some local potter, and it was a kind of very, very highly fired bisque finish. So almost chalky on the surface. And as we all sat in solemn silence, eating this really, really pretentious food in this barn-like atmosphere, all I could hear was people's knives and forks scraping on this stuff. And it was just like somebody filing the ends of your teeth with a surform tool. It was just repugnant. It ruined the entire evening, destroyed everything. The review I had to write was quite honestly viperous. But I think sound really, really shot it in the foot for them.
A fascinating issue, restaurant noise. That story of Tim Hayward's about the Hard Rock Cafe reminds me of when I went to the one on Piccadilly shortly after it opened in the early 1970s. And I can't remember much about the burger I ate, but I can remember the Jimi Hendrix memorabilia on the walls. But what I remember most was the crushing loudness of the music and how my friend Pablo and I just couldn't talk to each other till we got out again. It was extreme, and I never went back because of it.
Are there any places too noisy in Cambridge for you?
Well, actually, Jamie's.
Yeah.
In the domed bit was just excruciatingly noisy. Do you find anything?
Yeah, I have friends who insist on going to Chains, as much to my protestations, but we still do. And I just can't understand why, because they're so hot, there's so many echoes, it's so... Everything about it is completely opposite to what it should be for a nice, calm, relaxing cafe or restaurant in this case. Yeah. And they just keep going back and back and back.
Yeah.
There you go. Anyway, on to our next feature, and bottles per acre. How many thousands of bottles of wine per year can be produced? Now, that's a key question for large-scale wine producers who make the Yellowtail Chardonnay from Australia, for example. And it's equally important for a small family vineyard. Now, in northern Italy, they make Prosecco, and like many other things, there are many levels to Prosecco's quality. I caught up with Vine and Cork, and they import specialist Italian wines. They court small producers, they seek out flavours that they think will appeal to the UK market.
I was actually in Sicily last week, and I visited two winemakers. I noticed there is a trend for the family to take back control on the winemaking process. First, you can see it from branding wines with names of family members, but also going back to the old way of making wines.
Vine and Cork, run by three friends who had an idea over a bottle of wine. Andrea?
Yeah, my name is Andrea, and I'm Italian. Been living in England more than 10 years now.
Tiziano?
Until Sano Caldera. I've been living in the UK for 20 years. So one of the co-founders of Bynum Cork. Married, two daughters, grown up. So that's it. That's my life. I've been the first one to move into Cambridge.
Okay. And because of his wife, which introduced me to my wife.
Right,
my
that's,
wife. That's also a good reason.
Yeah. Yeah, we know each other a long time.
And John Piero, who was away on business.
The aptly named Sir not appearing in this film.
We always been around wine. Going and buy wine from producer for families is, there were many supermarkets, so you always used to go to producers, buy your big 50, 100 litres flask of wine. So I remember, you know, bottling wine with my dad, you know, almost since I can remember, really.
As a child in Italy, you drink wine. You get a glass of wine from your granddad on every meal, and you grow in a completely different perspective about drinking wine. When I met Gian Piero, we started to drink wine imported from Italy. And at that point, we started to say, there is a difference between wines. And that's how Bynum Cork started. One evening, drinking a Prosecco bottle in Andrea's garden.
Yeah, and obviously, we recognize that in the market, you need to have products that are recognizable as names, Chianti or Barolo, Prosecco, you know, everybody knows. And obviously, you know, we have that in our range. But what we like is the history behind that and try to explain how difficult it is for a producer to sort of bring back a grape that's been forgotten 10 plus years journey for them before they can get to the first bottle. We are not interested in selling just a bottle of wine. We want to sell the producer and also the story behind each of their like unique wine, for example, and that's almost always linked to some family history. For example, this Cecchetto, which is the producer of D'Arboso, he makes the Santa Rosso, which won many gold medal, made a name after his father. Or another producer that has a wine called Imperatore, which means emperor, made and named after one of the very old family ancestors, a descendant of an emperor. So it's this kind of story that I think just adds to the taste, if that's possible. Yeah, I know it might sound a poetic view, but we believe very much this concept.
Bynum Cork started with a bottle of Prosecco. So this bottle of Prosecco at that time was not imported into the UK. It was one of our Prosecco range. And even the Prosecco that today is like, you know, everybody talks about Prosecco. There's so much history on the Glera grape and the winemaker on the Val d'Obbiadene area. Now it became accessible in this way. I remember only 10 years ago, nobody in the UK was talking about Prosecco in the same way they're doing it today. And then now, you know, the price is driven the quantity, but unfortunately it's not driven the quality. That what made us to perform Bynum Cork, and what is just, it's our passion behind even selling a Prosecco bottle that is a completely different Prosecco that you can buy today from a supermarket.
But you also mentioned that there are grades of quality of Prosecco.
In our range in Bynum Cork, we have four different levels of Prosecco. Our base Prosecco is fantastic. And then you go to how you select the area where the grape comes from, the pyramid.
The pyramid that Tiziano is talking about is on their website, vineandcork.co.uk. Specifically, a section of their site called The Wine Lab. And now this is full of lots of well-written articles on aspects of Italian wine, wine regions, and their history, including Raboso, which is one of the oldest grapes known to man, to Italian wine classifications, so that you'll know the difference between, say, IGT, DOC, and DOCG classifications, and what that means, essentially, for the wine that you're considering. Now, the pyramid is in their Wine Lab pages on the website and explains the differences in qualities of Prosecco, for example.
And it's true. I remember, actually, when I came to the UK, Prosecco was not a drink in parties or the evening in the summer. And also in Italy right now, they're starting to say this Prosecco tipping point, craziness about Prosecco, is becoming also a worry for the original producer in Val d'Obbiadene, because then the pyramid is becoming a little bit wider at the base, and that is diluting the quality, and there's a lot of controls going on in Italy right now to really limit the quality of the Prosecco that is delivered. Not only in the UK, I'm talking also about the Italian market.
you know, as you can imagine, when a market grows and a product like that becomes so popular, then there's also a lot of doors that have been opened for the people that want to just make money and don't care about quality. So there's a lot of control police in Italy doing a very strict controls on big companies that maybe import grapes from the Eastern Europe where they can get cheaper material to then produce, you know, in mass quantity wine. As Tiziano said before, this cannot drive quality. So the, you know, our challenge is to try and explain that and make people understand that a Prosecco of a certain quality comes at a price, but it must come only from a specific area. That's why the pyramid of quality that you mentioned is very important.
And people are coming back and buying from us. And I say many times to Andrea and Gian Piero, you know, this is actually, there will be a turning point. At one point, quality will win.
So, as we said, Prosecco, yeah, nice drink, very popular, easy to drink, fresh, and people love it, so we obviously have it. But what we actually want to push is the spumante side of Italian sparkling, which is not the spumante that the public is familiar with a very cheap spumante, unfortunately, introduced in the market 20 years ago. But it is the true Italian sparkling wine. It's a much more complex wine, flavour and consistency much more for a connoisseur, if not the same as a champagne. So the spumante in general, compared to Prosecco, which is made and fermented with a second fermentation in still tank for 6 months and then bottled and sold, is a wine that needs to be consumed within a year. Our spumante, the minimum fermentation is 3 years, and we go up to a rosé spumante from the Rabosa grape, very interesting, very complex, is actually 6 years fermentation in a bottle. The price, yes, is not the Prosecco price, but it's not the quality champagne price, so it's much, much lower. So it's a very nice wine that is starting to become a little bit more popular. Obviously, it will take more time because we said, unfortunately, the label that the people look the most is the price one, but it's a champagne, but with much less cost.
So again, everything fits the vine and cork concept. The vine to the cork, the passion of the winemaker to enjoying a good quality glass of wine.
Did you mention that there's also a possibility of taking customers over to Italy?
Yes, we do, and that's actually our long-term goal. We actually designed and organized the first wine tour in Italy from the 5th to the 9th of September in collaboration with the Cooker School. We did organize this trip in the Langhe, which is basically the region in Piedmont, northwest of Italy, where like famous wine like Barolo, for example, everybody knows, come from. It's a UNESCO heritage region since 2013. It's a beautiful place, beautiful land, for a four-day trip in around all the towns.
To visit our two suppliers. We have two suppliers from the Langhe region, and they will be during the 4 days visiting both of them.
We then have, you know, walk in the vineyards, explain the history of, you know, our vines are grown, and of course in September we'll be right in the middle of the harvest season, which also will be from a emotional point of view something that people will definitely remember.
And I really hope that we can transfer everything that's happening in Italy, all the quality, all this increased focus on the family business and the passion, to the UK market.
Okay, Andrea, Tiziano, it's been great speaking to you. One thing we should mention for the listener is your contact details.
Yes, of course. So our website is vineandcork.co.uk.
Vine, not wine.
Many people say Vine and Cork. And we have a Twitter account, and you can follow us at vineandcork2017 in numbers, so 2017, or Facebook and Instagram at vineandcork official.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Warren. There you go, Vine and Cork, offering Italian wines and food culture, as well as collaborations with names like the Cambridge Cookery and Bistro and Biscotti di Debra, and plenty more in future. And as we heard, they're offering trips to the northern Italian wine region so you can really get that full Italian experience. And there's Green Onion signalling the start of our new section. We begin with jobs.
A Bantu in Hobson Street wants a person part-time, 25 to 35 hours a week. The main criterion is a genuine interest in coffee, baking and food. Pop in with your CV or for a chat.
A commis chef for a chef de partie is needed at the Burley Arms in Newmarket Road. You will be working 5 days out of seven. This is a full-time permanent position. And for more details, please call 07449 893 869.
two openings in central Cambridge, one a big brewer, unfortunately. Brewdog, not Brewboard, I'm sorry to say, is opening in the old cow premises in Bennett Street, and much more pleasing, there's going to be a big new Spanish restaurant in Green Street at the Trinity Street end where the Thai restaurant was until recently, and they're opening in 2 to 3 months or so, and it should be good. But that's it for today. We're here on alternate Saturdays at 1 and then podcast early the following week.
And don't forget, you can get in touch with us by email, flavour@cambridge105.co.uk, or Twitter, @flavour105.
And coming up next on Cambridge 105 Radio is Pete Butcher's with Jazz Today, featuring, amongst many others, the saxophone ensemble Q4. Polish Waves is at 5 o'clock. Now, this is the programme that's half in English and half in Polish, featuring music and entertainment geared around bringing British and Polish culture closer together. Summer Sports Week is at 6 p.m. with an in-depth look at this weekend's sporting action presented by Ollie Slack. And at 7, it's the Big Band Show. And this time around, John Hammond is focusing on American jazz drummer and bandleader Buddy Rich. Let the Good Times Roll is at 8 o'clock, curated rock and roll from the 50s through to today, presented by Jackie Bond. And Rebel Arts Radio is on at 9 with some left-field music, arts and opinion, with your hosts Pete Monahan, Mark Evans and Johnny Cabbage. Stagger is on at 11 p.m, featuring alternative rap, electronica and experimental music, presented by Tom Taylor, David Cunnington and Ian Shaw. And finally, Bookmark is at 11 with interviews and discussions with a host of Cambridge-based writers.
We'll be back on the 8th of June, but until then,
goodbye.